or have another print disability, which makes reading, holding a book, or turning a page difficult or impossible. The content is copyrighted by the respective publishers. For more information, please visit us on the web at nfradioreading.org.
Hello, this is Corrine, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the November 12, 2025 issue of the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Thank you for joining us today. The highlights under Tuesday, November 11th's paper, Business and Finance. Warren Buffett wrote that he will keep a significant amount of Berkshire Hathaway's Class A stock until shareholders grow comfortable with his successor as CEO, Greg Abel. A relief rally lifted major U.S. stock indexes, with the S&P 500 rising 1.5% and the NASDAQ and Dow gaining 2.3% and 0.8% respectively. Apollo agreed to acquire a majority stake in Spanish football club Atlético de Madrid, extending investors' interest in European soccer. Paramount reported growth from its streaming division in its first quarterly earnings report since the company's merger with David Ellison's Skydance Media. CoreWeave, one of the top providers of cloud computing services for AI firms, saw revenue more than double in the third quarter. Coinbase launched a platform to allow individual investors to purchase digital tokens before they are listed on its exchange. Diego appointed Dave Lewis as its chief executive, tapping a consumer industry veteran to revitalize the spirits company as it contends with faltering demand in the U.S. and China. KKR struck a deal to sell Novartia Group, a supplier to the aerospace and defense sector, to buyout firm Arcline for $2.2 billion in cash. Tyson Foods expect high beef prices to persist into next year as the U.S. cattle shortage continues to squeeze the meat packing industry's profits. Now for the key articles under the Worldwide section. The Senate passed a spending package to end the government shutdown, and the measure now goes to the House for a final vote. The decision by 8 members of the Democratic caucus to side with Republicans drew condemnation from other party members. Progressive voters are focusing their fury on Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer in the aftermath of what they see as a collapse by Senate Democrats. Chief Justice John Roberts enters his third decade leading the Supreme Court with a defining challenge of how far to let Trump's presidency rewrite the bounds of executive power. The Supreme Court rejected a long-shot bid to overturn the landmark 2015 decision that gave same-sex couples the constitutional right to marry. Trump pardoned top allies, including Rudy Giuliani, in connection with efforts to overturn the results of the 2020 presidential election. Trump threatened to file a $1 billion lawsuit against the BBC over the way the UK state broadcaster edited one of his speeches in a documentary. A car exploded in a densely populated New Delhi neighborhood near the Red Fort Monument, killing at least 8 people. The FDA said manufacturers should remove black box warnings on hormone replacement therapy drugs, citing clinical trials showing no association with increased breast cancer risk. Syria is joining fight against Islamic State. An agreement comes amid first ever visit by the nation's head of state to the White House by Alexander Ward, Michael R. Gordon, and Jared Maslin. Washington. Syria has joined the U.S.-led mission to defeat Islamic State, U.S. officials said, after President Trump and Syrian President Ahmed al-Shara met at the White House on Monday. The move marks a significant turnaround in the U.S. relationship with Syria. The decision is a sign of Syria's transition from a driver of Middle East instability as a result of former President Bashar al-Assad's violent crackdown on his own people, which allowed ISIS to flourish, into an ally aiding an American-led military operation to keep Islamic State at bay. Shara's rebel forces removed Assad from power last December. Shara has already met with Admiral Brad Cooper, the head of the U.S. Central Command, which oversees American forces in the region. But formally joining the campaign against the group known as ISIS paves the way for more extensive cooperation. Trump and Shara also discussed a pathway to reopen embassies in each other's capitals. During the visit, Syria announced it is joining the global coalition to defeat ISIS, said a senior U.S. administration official. Syria will thus become the 90th member of the D-ISIS coalition, partnering with the United States to eliminate ISIS remnants and halt foreign fighter flows. The United States will allow Syria to resume operations at its embassy in Washington to further counter terrorism, security, and economic coordination. From the opinion pages, Elise Stefanik aims for Albany. She is campaigning against Mandani, Hochul, and failed statist interventions. By William McGurn. There is a specter haunting New York, and it isn't capitalism. With the election of a young, popular socialist as mayor, the city is now bracing for a taxing regulatory wave that will try to make the Big Apple more affordable by taking money from some and giving it to others. Not so fast, says Representative Elise Stefanik, who last week announced that she is running for governor. Ms. Stefanik has represented New York's 21st congressional district since 2015. At the time, she was the youngest woman ever elected to Congress. Zoran Mandani may get his way in Albany, where most of the spending decisions affecting New York City are made. But Ms. Stefanik promises a fight. I am a born and raised New Yorker who grew up in a small business family and have seen firsthand that New York is the least friendly state in the nation when it comes to businesses, she says. Highest taxes, highest energy cost, highest insurance prices, most burdensome and costly regulations, and it's gotten worse. She calls incumbent Kathy Hochul the worst and weakest governor in America. Ms. Stefanik is dismayed at the thought that a socialist would have more moral credibility than Republicans on helping the poor and lower middle class. Republicans are the party of the American dream, ingenuity, entrepreneurship, and economic freedom and opportunity for families and businesses, she says. The polling showed that Mandani actually lost the working class and won the higher social economic demographics. It's a hint about the 2026 governor's race. As Ms. Stefanik has learned on the campaign trail, voters aren't interested in free market abstractions. They want to know, how would your proposals improve things for my family or business? In her 2014 race for Congress, when she was trying to flip an upstate seat from blue to red, she talked about how Obamacare made it difficult for her family's plywood distribution business. Premiums went up 30%, and co-payments and deductibles increased. That resonated with voters who ran small businesses. Ms. Stefanik says New York needs a total overhaul of the way it taxes, spends, and regulates. But Ms. Hochul doesn't want a debate on the return New Yorkers are getting on all that government. She and her fellow Democrats prefer to make it all about Donald Trump, and the press is happy to oblige. Another way of putting it is that New York Democrats don't have much in the way of achievements to talk about. In policy terms, the result is the vicious circle that is New York. Democrats raise taxes or subsidize something people don't want. When that fails, they simply propose more of the same taxes or government interventions that got them in trouble in the first place. Ms. Stefanik promises a different approach. People want the government off their backs so families and businesses can thrive to exceptional possibilities, she says. They know that not only is New York crushing families with taxes, but New Yorkers are getting such poor services and outcomes in return. Some of the worst health care, failing schools. We are New York, she adds, with a hint of exasperation. We should be number one. The Democrats' campaign strategy is to hang Mr. Trump around Ms. Stefanik's neck and hope to energize Democratic voters. It worked this year in New Jersey, where Democrat Mikey Sherrill defeated Republican Jack Cittarelli decisively in what was expected to be a close contest. Ms. Hochul is playing the same game. New York's voters have soundly thumped Mr. Trump in three presidential contests, although he received 750,000 more votes in New York last year than in 2016. Already, Ms. Hochul is running ads playing up her challenger's close ties to the president. Elise Stefanik, says one, is running for governor of New York to do what she's always done, put Trump first. Ms. Stefanik doesn't seem worried. Yes, New York is a blue state, and Mr. Trump is unpopular. But Mr. Trump isn't on the ballot, while Ms. Hochul will be, assuming she wins her primary. She received 400,000 fewer votes when she won in 2022 than he did when he lost the state in 2024. She'll also be stuck with Mayor Mandani because she endorsed him. New York is the most symbolic and watched city in the world, Ms. Stefanik says. We must save New York because it literally is saving Western civilization. It is the capital of finance. It fuels innovation, investment, and exceptional possibility. If she has her way, that will be the debate she has with Governor Hochul. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. From the editorial page, Democrats throw a shutdown tantrum. 8 senators are denounced for voting to reopen the government. Congratulations to the 7 Democrats and lone independent who voted to advance a bill to end the longest government shutdown in U.S. history. They put the country first, but the unbridled anger aimed by other Democrats at the 8 is a sign of the partisan times and more bitterness to come heading into 2026. The Senate was working Monday to pass a deal to reopen the government after the 8 defectors joined the GOP on Sunday to advance the measure in a 60-40 vote. Republican Rand Paul voted no, as he nearly always does, but the other 52 Republicans said aye. The reasonable Senate Democrats are Tim Kaine of Virginia, Maggie Hansen and Jean Shaheen of New Hampshire, John Fetterman of Pennsylvania, Jackie Rosen and Catherine Cortez Masto of Nevada, Dick Durbin of Illinois, and Maine Independent Angus King, who caucuses with Democrats. It wasn't working, Senator King said of the Democratic plan to keep the government closed until Republicans agreed to spend hundreds of billions more on Obamacare. He is acknowledging political reality as the shutdown pain grows. Government employees haven't been paid in weeks. The nation's air traffic is enduring mass cancellations and delays. One passenger we know sat at Newark Airport for more than 12 hours waiting for his flight to leave. Thanksgiving would have been a travel nightmare, which makes the cynical fury aimed at the 8 Senate defectors all the more remarkable. Pathetic, said California Governor Gavin Newsom. Representative Ro Khanna, another California Democrat with presidential ambitions, told Democratic Senate leader Chuck Schumer to resign, though the New Yorker voted against advancing the deal. These Democrats know they're hiding behind their colleagues who voted to reopen and who at least extracted retroactive pay for federal workers and the rehiring of those terminated during the shutdown. Senator Schumer and friends are playing to their base that didn't want a deal while also benefiting politically from reopening the government. Then again, you almost had to feel for Senator Schumer as he is forced to endure struggle sessions with the party's Mandani Red Guards. Every Democrat, even considering a run for the 2028 nomination, pandered to the never-compromise crowd. This is now the party's dominant wing. As for Republicans, they deserve credit for holding firm against the Democratic demand to extend pandemic-era Obamacare subsidies. Republicans gave Democrats a promise to hold a roll call vote on extending the subsidies, which paused in 2021 with no GOP support. The stopgap measure runs through January 30th, which avoids another funding cliff at Christmas when everyone wants to leave town fast. The deal's inclusion of full-year funding through September 30th for a few parts of the government, including agriculture and veterans affairs, lowers the risk of a big, ugly spending bill in January. The next GOP priority should be a spending bill for the U.S. military, which urgently needs the certainty of an appropriation to upgrade technology and equipment. The end of the shutdown should ease President Trump's pressure on Republicans to break the 60-vote filibuster rule to pass legislation. Over the weekend, Mr. Trump focused instead on Obamacare, calling it a scam that enriched insurers while health coverage only gets worse. This is a far better use of his political energy than targeting the filibuster, which is a bulwark against ever more entitlements. Democrats will still try to exploit Obamacare's ever upward prices to convince Mr. Trump and Republicans to bail out the law. Yet the lesson of the shutdown for Republicans is that they don't have to be healthcare hostages. They can propose their own ideas to help more Americans get a better insurance product than Obamacare. The lesson for Democrats is one the GOP knows from hard experience. Futile shutdown gestures are usually self-defeating. The bidding war for New York refugees. After Mandani's win, Tennessee is already trying to lure business. Zohran Mandani won't be sworn in as New York's socialist mayor for another 2 months, but the bidding war is already beginning for companies nervously eyeing the exits. Tennessee is open for business, Governor Bill Lee said in a video posted online late last week. And our Department of Economic and Community Development is ready to help you make a move right now. Nashville is looking more homey all the time, at least as a place to do business. This month, the Tax Foundation released its annual State Competitiveness Index, and Tennessee won the Most Improved Player Award, rising 30 spots over the past 6 years to number 8 overall. New York was dead last. Tennessee doesn't have an individual income tax, zip, zero, zilch. New York State's top rate on income is 10.9%. The Big Apple adds a local tax of 3.88% for a combined take of 14.8%, the highest anywhere in America. Mr. Mandani wants to increase that by another 2 points to 16.8%. Tennessee's top rate on corporate income is 6.5%. But it also taxes gross receipts, so it ranks poorly on the business portion alone. Yet, it still might look better than New York City. Albany's top rate on corporate income is 7.25%, and then the city's business tax goes up to 9% for a combined 16.25%. Mr. Mandani wants to add another 4.25 points, taking it above 20%. Businesses considering where to expand or whether to move a headquarters will factor in quality of life issues too, including crime, cost of living, housing availability, and more. New York City has much to offer. It's a magnet for talent, and the cultural amenities are enormous. But Broadway loses its luster if the streets and subways feel dangerous, and it's an open question how much Mr. Mandani will handcuff the New York Police Department. The mayor-elect hasn't yet revealed a pragmatic streak, but if Mr. Mandani doesn't find one, New York's loss will be Tennessee's gain, to say nothing of Texas, Florida, and the rest. Now for today's paper, November 12th, 2025. The picture on the front page shows flags waving and military parades on Veterans Day. The caption, "In the ranks, members of the Navy marched up Fifth Avenue in New York City for the Veterans Day parade, one of many celebrations Tuesday. More military families facing a financial squeeze have been showing up at food pantries." Now for the key articles under today's What's News Business and Finance. A path for interest rate cuts has been clouded by an emerging split within the central bank with little precedent during the Fed Chair Jerome Powell's nearly 8-year tenure. Major U.S. stock indexes ended mixed, with the S&P 500 and Dow rising 0.2% and 1.2% respectively, and the NASDAQ falling 0.3%. The U.S. shed an average of 11,250 private sector jobs a week in the 4 weeks ended October 25th, ADP said. Anthropic is on track to turn a profit much faster than its artificial intelligence rival, OpenAI, documents from the companies indicate. SoftBank sold its stake in NVIDIA for $5.8 billion as the global tech investor pulls together cash to plow into its massive bet on OpenAI. Shortages of advanced semiconductors are so acute that Beijing has begun intervening in how the output of China's largest contract chip maker, SMIC, is distributed. Microsoft and Google said they would invest more than $16 billion to expand artificial intelligence infrastructure in Europe. Blackstone's global co-head of real estate, Kathleen McCarthy Baldwin, said she plans to leave the firm at the end of the year. Vodafone shares rose after the company returned to top-line growth in Germany after being hampered by regulatory changes there for more than a year. Now for the highlights under the worldwide section. Fannie Mae watchdogs, who were removed from their jobs, had been probing if Trump appointee Bill Pulte had improperly obtained mortgage records of key Democratic officials, including New York Attorney General Letitia James. The U.S. Navy's largest aircraft carrier arrived in waters near Latin America, expanding the military's buildup as the Trump administration seeks to increase pressure on Venezuela's President Maduro. The Supreme Court said the Trump administration could continue, for now, to withhold funds to pay the full amount of federal food assistance benefits for November. China plans to ease the flow of rare earths and other restricted materials to the U.S. with a system that distinguishes between acceptable and unacceptable end users. The Trump administration is poised to unveil a plan that would allow oil drilling off California and a proposal for drilling around Alaska and the eastern Gulf of Mexico. Pakistan blamed India-backed militants for a suicide bombing that killed 12 people in Islamabad, as India vowed to hunt down the perpetrators of a car explosion in New Delhi the day before. Infant formula maker ByHeart recalled all of its products in the U.S. after the FDA opened an investigation of a multi-state botulism outbreak. Died Sally Kirkland, 84, stage and screen performer. Articles from today's front page. China plots victory in AI Cold War. U.S. holds sizable lead, but Beijing bets that swarms beat the titan. By Josh Chin and Raphael Wang. China's leaders were anxious and frustrated. The world's most promising new technology was being dominated by OpenAI, Google, and other American companies. Chinese tech companies were so far behind on generative artificial intelligence early last year that many were relying on Meta Platform's open source Llama models, which can be downloaded for free. Worse, U.S. restrictions on exports of top-end AI chips threatened to hobble China even further. So in the spring of 2024, Beijing ratcheted up pressure on tech executives. One leading Chinese AI company told the Wall Street Journal it fielded calls from 10 different government agencies in a single month urging action on native AI models. The country relaxed regulations, rolled out funding, and rushed to install computing power. 9 months later, Chinese startup DeepSeek turned heads in Silicon Valley with a powerful new AI model. Hope began to take hold. China finally has a model it can be proud of, Premier Li Kao told officials, according to people familiar with the comment. The optimism catalyzed China's tech industry, unleashed an even bigger geyser of government support, and jolted American competition into overdrive. The escalating AI race is drawing comparisons with the Cold War and the great scientific and technological clashes that characterized it. It is likely to be at least as consequential. The contest is already helping underpin a worldwide surge in tech spending that has juiced the U.S. and Chinese stock markets and unlocked new sources of economic growth, even as it fuels fears of a global AI bubble. It is poised to transform industry, society, and geopolitics. It's pushing leaders to sideline concerns about the dangers of powerful AI models, including the spread of disinformation and other harmful content, and the development of superintelligence AI systems misaligned with human values. Both countries are driven as much by fear as by hope of progress. In Washington and Silicon Valley, warnings abound that China's authoritarian AI, left unchecked, will erode American tech supremacy. Beijing is gripped by the conviction that a failure to keep pace in AI will make it easier for the U.S. to cut short China's resurgence as a global power. Both countries believe market share for their companies across the world is up for grabs, and with it, the potential to influence large swaths of the global population. The U.S. still has a clear lead, producing the most powerful AI models. China can't match it in advanced chips and has no answer for the financial firepower of private American investors. But it has a massive population of capable engineers, lower cost, and a state-led development model that often moves faster than the U.S., all of which Beijing is working to harness to tip the contest in its direction. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. December rate cut decision divides the Fed. Data blackout fueled inflation hawks' bid to pause reductions. Rupture tests Powell. By Nick Timiraos. The path for interest rate cuts has been clouded by an emerging split within the central bank with little precedent during the Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell's nearly 8-year tenure. Officials are fractured over which poses the greater threat, persistent inflation or a sluggish labor market? And even a resumption of official economic data might not bridge the differences. The rupture has complicated what looked like a workable plan less than 2 months ago, though investors think a rate cut at the Fed's next meeting is still more likely than not. When policymakers agreed to cut rates by a quarter of a percentage point in September, 10 of 19 officials, a slim majority, penciled in cuts for October and December. Cutting rates at 3 consecutive meetings would echo the downward adjustments Powell made last year and in 2019. But a contingent of hawks questioned the need for further reductions. Their resistance hardened after officials reduced rates again in late October to the current range between 3.75% and 4%. The debate over what to do in December was especially contentious, with hawks forcefully challenging the presumption of a third cut, according to public comments in recent interviews. Indeed, a key reason Powell pushed back so bluntly against expectations of such a cut at the news conference that day was to manage a committee riven by seemingly unabridgeable differences. The split was exacerbated by the shutdown, which turned off the employment and inflation reports that can help reconcile such disagreements. The data void allowed officials to cite private surveys or anecdotes that reinforced earlier assessments. The dynamic reflected two contingents growing louder and a center with less conviction. Doves worried about labor market softness but lacked new evidence that would maintain a strong case for cutting. Hawks seized the opportunity to argue for a pause. They pointed to steady consumer spending and signaled concern that businesses were preparing to pass along tariff-related price increases. Whether officials cut rates again at the December 9th to 10th meeting is a toss-up. New data could settle the debate. Some officials view the December and January meetings as largely interchangeable, making the year-end deadline feel somewhat artificial. Another possibility, pairing a December cut with guidance that sets a higher bar for further reductions. Anthropic leads OpenAI in profit race by Berber Jin. The finances of Silicon Valley's two largest artificial intelligence startups show their diverging approaches to the AI boom, with Anthropic on a pace to turn a profit far more quickly than rival OpenAI, according to documents obtained by the Wall Street Journal. Anthropic, which has a growing number of business users because of the capabilities of its Claude chatbot in coding and other arenas, expects to break even for the first time in 2028, the documents show. By contrast, OpenAI forecast its operating losses that year to swell to about $74 billion, or about three-fourths of revenue, because of ballooning spending on computing cost. The ChatGPT maker also expects to burn through about 14 times as much cash as Anthropic before turning a profit in 2030. The financial roadmaps both shared with investors this summer suggests that the world's two most valuable AI startups are taking vastly different approaches to growing their businesses. OpenAI expects thinner margins than Anthropic from its sales for the next 5 years. Yet, it is investing far more in the chips and data centers needed to build its AI technology and doling out more stock-based compensation to attract top researchers. The aggressive plan reflects Chief Executive Sam Altman's dream of turning OpenAI into a multi-trillion dollar tech giant, his desire to set the pace of the AI boom, and his seemingly unending tolerance for risk. The strategy requires near-constant fundraising to keep the startup alive and could backfire if markets cool on the technology or its near-term profitability. Warship's arrival ratchets up pressure on Venezuela by Michael R. Gordon. The U.S. Navy's largest aircraft carrier arrived in waters near Latin America on Tuesday, expanding a military buildup as the Trump administration seeks to ratchet up the pressure on Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro. President Trump has expressed reservations about taking military action against Venezuela, the Wall Street Journal reported last week. But the arrival of the USS Gerald R. Ford carrier strike group, with several destroyers equipped with Tomahawk missiles, will boost the U.S. military's capability to attack targets in the country. Pentagon spokesman Sean Parnell said the carrier group will enhance and augment existing capabilities to disrupt narcotics trafficking and degrade and dismantle transnational criminal organizations. The strike group's firepower, however, goes beyond what is required to strike the small boats that the Trump administration says are being used to smuggle drugs. The U.S. has carried out 19 strikes on boats in the Caribbean and in the Eastern Pacific. The attacks have killed 76 people, the administration says, and spurred a debate about whether the strikes are legal. In the latest strike Sunday, 6 men were killed in 2 attacks in the Pacific, said Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth. Colombian President Gustavo Petro said that as long as the boat strikes continue, his country will suspend dealings with U.S. security agencies. He made the announcement Tuesday after CNN reported that the U.K. has stopped sharing intelligence with the U.S. about suspected drug vessels in the Caribbean. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. From the editorial page, a 50-year mortgage is a bad deal. Trump seems to have bought Bill Pulte's high-risk brainstorm. The Democratic route in last week's elections has President Trump hunting for ideas to reduce cost, but he's looking in all the wrong places. Behold his latest gambit, a 50-year mortgage. This is a recipe for making housing less affordable while increasing risks for taxpayers who stand behind most mortgages. High home prices are a problem, having soared 56% since January 2020. Two reasons are excessive government spending that fueled inflation and historically low pandemic-era interest rates. The Federal Reserve then had to raise rates to bring inflation under control. The result? Average monthly payments on a new home have climbed some 80% over the last 5 years. This means fewer young people can afford a home. The median age of first-time buyers this year reached an all-time high of 40, compared to the late 20s in the 1980s. Public surveys show the cost of housing is an acute worry for young Americans. Enter Mr. Trump, who seems to have been sold on the 50-year mortgage by Bill Pulte, who runs the Federal Housing Finance Agency, FHFA. The aim is to reduce monthly payments by amortizing the loan over a longer period. Instead of paying down the principal over 30 years, borrowers would do so over 50. A 50-year mortgage could cut monthly payments by a few hundred dollars, but it would also increase the interest borrowers pay by hundreds of thousands of dollars over the life of the loan. Borrowers might also have to pay higher interest rates to compensate for the greater risk of default over 50 years. We've seen this scary movie before. As the housing bubble inflated, Fannie Mae began buying more 40-year mortgages, which let borrowers take out bigger loans than they could otherwise afford. Borrowers were slower to build equity, and many walked away from their mortgages when home prices collapsed. Or consider today's subprime auto market. As car prices rose with inflation, auto dealers extended the duration of loans for less creditworthy borrowers. Some struggling borrowers are now turning in their keys and leaving lenders with big losses. Others who want to trade in their cars to buy a new one can't afford to do so, because they owe more than their car is worth. The 2008 housing meltdown spurred the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau and the FHFA to limit mortgage terms to 30 years. Mr. Pulte says he's working to change that. Introducing a 50-year mortgage will boost housing demand, which will benefit Mr. Pulte's friends in the home building and mortgage banking industries. But it will also lead to higher prices. This is what the government's many demand-side housing interventions over the years have done. As home prices rose, the government eased underwriting standards so buyers could take on bigger mortgages as a share of their income. This reduced borrowers' financial wiggle room if their expenses increased, as they have over the past few years. Nearly 70% of new Federal Housing Administration, FHA, borrowers last year had debt-to-income ratios exceeding 43%, which is considered risky. That's up from 28% in 2012. About 38% of new Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac borrowers last year had risky debt-to-income ratios compared to 16% in 2012. Recent buyers are more leveraged than they were in the bubble days. Stretched by inflation, rising property taxes, and insurance costs, many have been struggling to meet mortgage payments. No worries, the Biden administration paid mortgage services to prevent foreclosures. This includes letting delinquent borrowers extend their loan terms to 40 years and reduce monthly payments by 25%. Repeatedly miss your mortgage payments? Congratulations, you qualify for mortgage relief. Talk about moral hazard. The FHA has paid mortgage services to provide forbearance or modify some 610,000 FHA mortgages over the last year. That's more than the number of new purchase loans FHA insured last year. Yikes! Writing down mortgages for distressed borrowers is a booming business for mortgage bankers. But keeping people in homes they can't afford means there are fewer available to buy, which makes housing less affordable for everyone else. That's what a 50-year mortgage will do, too. From the opinion pages, how the Heritage Foundation lost its way. The think tank gave up its independence and became partisan. That explains why it's been struggling. From Jason L. Riley. Vice President J.D. Vance said in the wake of last week's election and the Heritage Foundation fiasco that infighting among Republicans is stupid. But sometimes infighting can be constructive. In the 1960s, William F. Buckley famously shunned conspiracy-minded birchers to the lasting benefit of the conservative movement. The current effort to marginalize figures such as Tucker Carlson, Steve Bannon, and Nick Fuentes is evidence that the political right is still capable of policing itself. Probably no one who read Kate O'Dell's interview with Heritage President Kevin Roberts in these pages 2 years ago was surprised by his recent behavior. The organization isn't what it used to be. Not long ago, Heritage stood for defending America's democratic allies against aggression from bad actors. Mr. Roberts spent most of the journal interview explaining why we should abandon Ukraine in its fight against Russia and focus on domestic issues, as if we can't do both. The U.S. is a lot weaker than it used to be, he said, and it can't be as active and interventionalist as we might otherwise be. Heritage's position on free markets, immigration, and other domestic issues have also evolved. The changes predate Mr. Roberts, but have accelerated on his watch. These days, the organization's leadership seems most interested in staying in the good graces of Trump populist and social media superstars, even if that means defending Mr. Carlson's appalling decision to humor racist cranks. In a recent interview on the Dispatch podcast, conservative activist Tim Chapman contrasted Mr. Roberts' priorities with those of Ed Fuelner, 1941 to 2025, who co-founded Heritage in 1973 as a counterweight to the Brookings Institution and other liberal think tanks. It was right-leaning but existed outside of the GOP, a place where conservative ideas could develop, incubate, and ultimately inform Republican policy initiatives. The Republican Party and the conservative movement have never been the exact same thing, said Mr. Chapman, who worked at Heritage for more than 10 years. The politicians have benefited by having a conservative movement that was outside of them and called them to higher standards. Historically, that's what Heritage did. Mr. Chapman recalled a story about Fuelner's opposition to George H.W. Bush's plan to raise taxes. After a meeting where Fuelner aired his misgivings, the U.S. president told the Heritage president, "You'll never be invited back to this White House." Fuelner responded, "With all due respect, Mr. President, Heritage will be here a long time after you're gone." According to Mr. Chapman, Heritage consciously decided to alter its mission. It is becoming the enforcer of the party leadership. What the White House proposes, Heritage advocates, regardless of the policy's merit or the organization's past positions. The rationalization is that the country faces an existential crisis and that the Trump movement is the only way to save it from the political left. Mr. Chapman's assessment may be correct. Unfortunately, too many people on the left and right now traffic in apocalyptic scenarios should their political opponents prevail. The reality is that the country remains divided, but democracy isn't under mortal threat, as evidenced by the robust turnout in last week's off-year elections. Think tanks can still have a positive role in our political debates, and many of them do. But Heritage would do better to change course and return to its roots. Conservatism needs organizations like Heritage far more than the left does. You've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the November 12, 2025 issue of the Wall Street Journal, which we read every Monday through Thursday at 11 p.m. Your reader has been Corrine. Thank you for listening.
If you or people you know shop at any of the Dash's supermarkets, please save Dash's register tapes for radio reading. Our agency receives $2 for every $100 in Dash's register tapes. Radio Reading has raised thousands of dollars so far. Anyone can drop off their Dash's tapes to the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service at 1199.